Chapter 4.
Okay.
We agnostics, that's right. They have a whole chapter about that.
We agnostics.
And in the beginning I told you there's a purpose and an object of the book. Alright? The purpose is in the foreword of the first edition and the very beginning. And what it says, and I'll get to it real quick here. I should have had it already ready. To show other alcoholics precisely how we have recovered is the main purpose of the book. Alright? And it starts, in the preceding chapters you've learned something about alcoholism. We hope you've learned something about it. We hope you've made a clear distinction between the alcoholic and the non-alcoholic. If, when you honestly want to, you find you cannot quit entirely. If you honestly want to, and you can't quit entirely, or if when drinking, you have little control over the amount you take, you are probably alcoholic. Now, that's one of the first times when they're giving you an idea of you are an alcoholic. If you can't control the amount, or you want to quit honestly, and you can't. If that be the case, you may be suffering from an illness only a spiritual experience will conquer. That's the entire program of Alcoholics Anonymous, is a spiritual experience to conquer what we came in here for, and that was to quit drinking. And pretty soon we're going to find out that that's not our real problem. To one who feels he's an atheist or an agnostic, such an experience seems impossible, but to continue as he is means disaster, especially if he is an alcoholic of the hopeless variety, mine. Helpless and hopeless. Here's a promise. Now, promises in this book aren't always rosy and, you know, pretty. Sometimes a promise is what this says right here, to be doomed. That's a promise. To be doomed to an alcoholic death or to live on a spiritual basis are not always easy alternatives to face. A or B, doomed to an alcoholic death or live on a spiritual basis. Where's door three? I want door three. Give me another option.
They did, or else. That's your door three, or else.
That's it, to be doomed. But it isn't so difficult. About half our original fellowship, and right now we're still with the first 100, about half our original fellowship were exactly of that type. At first, some of us tried to avoid the issue, hoping against hope we were not true alcoholics. But after a while, we had to face the fact that we must. Anybody ever tell you there's no must in Alcoholics Anonymous? Must is going to be used about 113 times. But we must find a spiritual basis of life, or else. There it is, the or else. Perhaps it's going to be that way with you, but cheer up. Something like half of us thought we were atheists or agnostic. Our experience shows that you need not be disconcerted. If a mere code of morals or a better philosophy of life were sufficient to overcome alcoholism, many of us would have recovered long ago. Code of morals or a better philosophy of life. But we found that such codes and philosophies did not save us no matter how much we tried. We could wish to be moral. We could wish to be philosophically comforted. In fact, we could will these things with all our might. But the needed power wasn't there. Our human resources, as marshaled by the will, by our will, were not sufficient. They failed utterly. And here it comes. What is my problem? My problem is lack of power. That was our dilemma. We had to find a power by which we could live, and it had to be a power greater than ourselves, obviously. But where and how would we define this power? Here comes the object of the book. Well, that's exactly what this book is about. Its main object is to enable you to find a power greater than yourself, which will solve your problem. Remember earlier it said solve all your problems? Will solve your problem. Not your alcohol problem. Your problem. What is your problem today? If it's not alcohol, what is your problem? A spiritual solution, a spiritual principle, will solve it. That means we've written a book which we believe to be spiritual as well as moral, and it means, of course, that we are going to talk about God. Here difficulty arises with the agnostic. Many times we talk to a new man and watch his hopes rise as we discuss his alcoholism or his alcoholic problems and explain our fellowship. But his face falls when we speak of spiritual matters, especially when we mention God. For we have reopened a subject which our man thought he had neatly evaded or entirely ignored. We know how he feels. We have shared his honest doubt and prejudice. Some of us have been violently anti-religious. To others, the word God brought up a particular idea of him with which someone had tried to impress them during their childhood. Someone tried to cram a certain type of God down somebody's throat during childhood. Perhaps we rejected this particular conception because it seemed inadequate. With that rejection, we imagined we had abandoned the God idea entirely. We were bothered with the thought that faith and dependence on a power beyond ourselves was somewhat weak, even cowardly. We looked upon this world of warring individuals, warring theological systems, and inexplainable calamity with deep skepticism. We looked askew at many individuals who claimed to be godly. How could a supreme being have anything to do with it all? And who could comprehend a supreme being anyway? Yet in other moments, we found ourselves thinking, when enchanted by a starlight night, who then made all this? There was a feeling of awe and wonder, but it was fleeting and soon lost, especially when I was drinking. You know, up here in Georgia and Alabama, man, you have just the clearest skies at night when there's no clouds. It seems like the Milky Way is sitting right on top of my house. You know, I don't see that down in Orlando. Too many lights in the city. But you look up there and just think to yourself, this is all just, you know, random existence. We're just randomly here. We crawled out of the primordial ooze, it'll tell us, right? I lost my tail somewhere along the line. I stood up and walked. Explain to me how, right now, you're traveling at 17,000 miles an hour. Can you do it? You're a teacher. Can you do it?
No.
Do you know you're traveling at 17,000 miles an hour?
No.
Do you know the Earth rotates at 17,000 miles an hour?
No.
So right now, we're standing still on terra firma, ground, but we're spinning at 17,000 miles an hour. Think that's just a random act of the universe? There is a feeling of awe and wonder. Yes, we have agnostic temperament, have had these thoughts and experiences. Let us make haste to reassure you. We found that as soon as we were able to lay aside prejudice and express, remember those words I told you in the beginning, express even a willingness to believe in a power greater than ourselves, we commenced to get results, even though it was impossible for any of us to fully define or comprehend that power which is God. And this is what Ebby told Bill. Much to our relief, we discovered we did not need to consider another's conception of God. I don't have to believe in your God. You don't have to believe in mine. You don't even know whose mine is. Because it tells me in here that that's a personal matter. I don't discuss it. Not even with my sponsees. Out of all the men I've sponsored, I don't think I've ever shared who my God is. I just told them they need to find something greater than me. In the beginning, it was a group of drunks. Then it was a sponsor. And then finally, when they get to this chapter, they realize they really got to find a power greater than human aid. Much to our relief, we discovered that we need to consider another conception of God. Our own conception, however inadequate, was sufficient to make the approach and to effect a contact with him or her. As soon as we admitted the possible existence of a creative intelligence, a spirit of the universe underlying the totality of things, we began to be possessed of a new sense of power and direction, provided we took other simple steps. 4 through 9. We found that God does not make too hard of terms with those who seek him. To us, the realm of the spirit is broad, roomy, all-inclusive, never exclusive or forbidding, to those who earnestly seek, it is open, we believe, to all men and women. I tell my guys, my God's a gentleman. He does not go where he's not invited. So if you have a God, make him a gentleman or a gentlewoman and invite him into your life. So on top of page 47, it goes on, when therefore we speak to you of God, we mean your own conception of God. This applies to other spiritual expressions which you find in this book. Had I walked in the room and looked at the steps and said, turn my lives over to Allah as I understand it, I'm out the door, I'm drunk, I'm dead. If it had said Jesus, I'm out the door, I'm drunk, I'm dead. If it said Buddha, I'm out the door. What it said was, find your own. Whatever you believe in, find your own. And then rely on him and seek him. Don't let any prejudice you may have against spiritual terms deter you from honestly asking yourself what they mean to you. At the start, this was all we needed to commence spiritual growth, to affect our first conscious relations with God as we understood it. Afterward, we found ourselves accepting many things which then seemed entirely out of reach. That was growth. But if we wished to grow, we had to begin somewhere. You can't start where you ain't. So we used our own conception, however limited it was. We needed to ask ourselves but one short question. Okay? We're going to ask ourselves a question. Do I now believe, or am I even willing to believe, that there is a power greater than myself? As soon as a man can say that he does believe or is willing to believe, step two, we emphatically assure him that he is on his way. It has been repeatedly proven among us that upon this simple cornerstone, a wonderfully effective spiritual structure can be built. Now, I'm not real good on architect, but I do know the cornerstone of the foundation is where you start from. And so the willingness to believe in a power greater than myself was my cornerstone to start my growth in Alcoholics Anonymous. And again, we see the snowflake or the asterisk. And for the third time in the first 47 pages, the third time, it asks us to go to the back of the book and read the spiritual appendix. The first time it was on page 25. The second time it was on page 27. Now on page 47. First it says go back to read it, then it says further amplified, and then it says please be sure to read the appendix on spiritual experience. There, one, you understand, you don't have to have a white light, bright light experience like Bill Wilson did. That most of us come to an understanding, like William James talks about, as an educational experience. We learn about God. We don't have God come, you know, I used to say, you know, if there's a God, why didn't he just throw those tablets down and burn those things? You know what? If I'm holding two pieces of rock and God starts writing on them, I'm going to freak out. I can't handle that, you know, but I'm going to know it's God. I'm good with the God I got. I'm real good with the God I got, because he doesn't throw me out under the bus like I throw myself out, like the jaywalker. And that was great news for us, for we assumed we could not make use of spiritual principles unless we accepted many things on faith which seemed difficult to believe. When people presented us with the spiritual approaches, how frankly did we all say, I wish I had what that man has. I'm sure it'd work if I could only believe as he believes. But I cannot accept as surely true the many articles of faith which are plain to him. So it was comforting to learn that we could commence at a simpler level. Okay, now, I am not going to go back and read the whole spiritual experience. When we do a big book meeting, normally, every time we see something like that, we go back and we read it again. We've read it twice, so we're not going to do that, but please do it over and over. Because the thing about contemporary investigation was what kept me drunk for 3.5 years. You know? I just didn't believe this was going to work for me. So I wouldn't try. That's contemporary to investigation. Besides the seeming inability to accept much on faith, we often found ourselves handicapped by that word, sensitiveness and unreasoning prejudice. Many of us have been so touchy that even casual reference to spiritual things made us bristle with antagonism. This sort of thinking had to be abandoned. Though some of us resisted, we found no great difficulty in casting aside such feelings. Faced with alcoholic destruction, we soon became as open-minded on spiritual matters as we had tried to be on other questions. In this respect, alcohol was the great persuader. It finally beat us into a state of reasonableness. And a little note I've got next to mine is, how long is up to you? How long do you want to be beat before you'll get in a state of reasonableness? Sometimes this was a tedious process. We hope no one else will be prejudiced for as long as some of us were. You know, I thought 3.5 years was a long time. When my sponsor first went into an AA meeting to get sober in Scotland, they said 90 meetings in 90 days. And so he went to 90 meetings in 90 days, and he didn't drink. And on the 91st day, he and his wife and his kids were on their way down to London, and he stopped in the liquor store, and he said, there it is, 90 days, 90 meetings, 90 days, cured. Bought a half gallon of whiskey, and for the next 12 years, he never got 90 days again. For 12 years, he was in and out of the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous, and he could never get 90 days again. Until he finally surrendered. The reader may still ask why you should believe in a power greater than himself. We think there are good reasons. Let's look at some of them. The particular individual of today is a stickler for facts and results. Nevertheless, the 20th century readily accept theories of all kinds provided they are firmly grounded in fact. Dr. Silkworth's opinion in the front of the book was originally the doctor's theory. Because it just wasn't proof. Now, when the second book was printed in 1955, Dr. Silkworth allowed them to put his name in the book. Because after that period of time, it was fact. He was right. A lot of people don't know that. Everybody believes them without a murmur of doubt. Oh, we have numerous theories, for example, about electricity. Everybody believes them without a murmur of doubt. Why this readily acceptance? Simply because it's impossible to explain what we see, feel, direct, and use without a reasonable assumption as a starting point. Now, I come in here, I flip on a light switch, the lights come on, right? Do I know how that happens? Well, there's some big nuclear coal plant down the road, and it's doing something. I don't know what it's doing. Burning something, heating something, doing something, and then somehow or another that goes into electrical lines, and they run down here, and they run in here, and it goes into a breaker box. It's got breakers. I don't know how any of that stuff works. No clue. Other than if I touch it, it's like a hot stove. I'm going to get burnt. Right? But I got no clue how all that works. Some of you are smarter than me. All of you are smarter than me. Let's just go with that. All of you are smarter than me, and you might know how electricity works. I got no clue. All I know, if the light switch doesn't come on, I got to call the power company. Maybe I need to check the breakers in the box first, but I don't ever do that. They always tell me to do it, and then I go find out the breakers broke. Everybody nowadays believes in scores of assumptions, but for which there's good evidence but no perfect visual proof. And does not science demonstrate that visual proof is the weakest proof? It is being constantly revealed as mankind studies the material world, okay, that outward appearances are not inward reality at all. Outward appearances are not inward. You ever seen people coming into an AA meeting and they look sharp and they dress sharp and you ask them how they're doing? I'm doing great. Do you really know what's going on inside that person? No, you really don't. All I know is if you come in and your face is dragging, I know you're hurting. But if you come in and tell me you're great, I'm thinking, I hope so. You know, but I don't know. I'm not in your shoes. You got to be honest with me. I'm going to skip a little bit over onto page 49, and I'm going to go and start where it says, when, however, the perfect logical assumption is suggested that underneath the material world and life as we see it, there is an all-powerful, guiding, creative intelligence, right there our perverse streak comes to the surface, and we laboriously set out to convince ourselves it isn't true. It isn't so. We read wordy books and indulge in windy arguments, thinking we believe this universe needs no God to explain it. Were our contentions true, it would follow that life originated out of nothing means nothing, and proceeds nowhere. We're just here floating around, and then we're just going to be in a black hole. If that's what you want to believe, believe it. I don't believe that. Instead of regarding ourselves as intelligent agents, spearheads of God's ever advancing creation, we agnostic and atheists chose to believe that our human intelligence was the last word, the Alpha and the Omega, the beginning and the end. And then it says, rather vain of us, wasn't it? We who have traveled this dubious path, the people who have written this book, beg you to lay aside prejudice even against organized religion. We have learned that whatever human frailties of various faiths may be, those faiths have given purpose and direction to millions. If 2.5 million people around the world are sober today in Alcoholics Anonymous, why do I walk in the room and say, it won't work for me? Contempt prior to investigation. Right? People of faith have a logical idea of what life is all about. Actually, we used to have no reasonable conception whatever. We used to amuse ourselves by cynically dissecting spiritual beliefs and practices when we might have observed that many spiritually minded persons of all races, colors, and creeds were demonstrating a degree of stability, happiness, and usefulness which we should have sought ourselves. Many spiritually minded persons of every race, color, creed have a degree of stability, happiness, and usefulness, which is what I want in my life. And I should have sought it a long time ago. Page 50. Instead, we looked at the human defects of these people and sometimes used their shortcoming as basis of wholesale condemnation. Now, I can tell you, that was me. I was raised in a military family. We went all over the world. I played with black children, Chinese children, Japanese children. Never was a racist. And I went to church a couple times with my grandmother down in Orlando just to go with my grandmother because she asked me to go. And I would see somebody in that church, and then I would see them the next day, and they would be using the N-word like it was just no problem. And I would go, see, that whole church is full of hypocrites because of one man. Condemn the entire Catholic religion because of one priest does something wrong. I can't do that. But I did. That's where my judgment took me. We talked of intolerance while we were intolerant ourselves. We missed the reality and the beauty of the forest because we were diverted by the ugliness of some of its trees. Could see the forest for the trees, right? We never gave the spiritual side of life a fair hearing. Now, it's already said once that they hope the personal stories in the back of the book are not offensive. And I've already told you that the personal stories in the back of the book should be read after you do the 12 steps. Okay? You can read some of them. The thing about acceptance is the key. It used to be called Dr. Alcoholic Addict. But every story in the back of the book is a speaker in print. And that's the way I look at it. And every story in the back of the book is somebody sharing their experience, strength, and hope. And every story ends with how they came to believe in a power greater than themselves. Every one of them. In our personal stories, you'll find a wide variation of the way each teller approaches and conceives of the power which is greater than himself. Whether we agree with a particular approach or conception seems to make little difference. I don't care how somebody got to their power. I just know that if I'm working with somebody, they need a power, and I ain't it. You know? I can explain things to them, but they need a power greater than me. And I'm pretty strong. Whether we agree seems to make little difference. Experience has taught us that these are matters for which, for our purpose, we need not be worried. These are questions for each individual to settle for himself. Each one of you has to settle these on your own. On one proposition, however, these men and women are strikingly agreed. Every one of them has gained access to and believes in a power greater than himself. Talking about the stories in the back. This power has, in each case, accomplished the miraculous, the humanly impossible. As a celebrated American statement put it, let's look at the record. Here are thousands of men and women, worldly indeed. They flatly declare that since they have come to believe in a power greater than themselves, to take a certain attitude towards that power and to do certain simple things, steps 4 through 9, there has been a revolutionary change in their way of living and thinking. In the face of collapse and despair, in the face of total failure on their human resources, they found that a new power, peace, happiness, and sense of direction flowed into them. This happened soon after they wholeheartedly met a few simple requirements. Now, we talked about requirements back on page 25. Few simple requirements, okay? Steps 4 through 9. Once confused and baffled by the seeming futility of existence, they show the underlying reasons why they were making heaven going of life. Leaving aside the drink question. So take alcohol out of it. They tell why living was so unsatisfactory. They show how the change came over them when many hundreds of people are able to say that the consciousness of the presence of God is today the most important fact of their lives. They present a powerful reason why one should have faith. When many hundreds of people, now we're talking 2013, when many millions of people are able to say that the consciousness of the presence of God is today the most important fact of their lives, they present a powerful reason why one should have faith. Okay? Now, it's going to talk about Galileo, and it's going to talk about Columbus, and, you know, Columbus thought the earth was round. They thought he was going to go off the side of the earth. Galileo, he was going to be put to death for his astronomical heresies. The bottom of 51, last paragraph. We ask ourselves this. Are not some of us just as biased and unreasonable about the realm of the spirit as were the ancients about the realm of the material? Even in the present century, American newspapers were afraid to print an account of the Wright brothers' first successful flight at Kitty Hawk. They didn't want to print it because they didn't believe it. Had not all the efforts at flight failed before? Did not Professor Langley's flying machine go to the bottom of the Potomac River? Anybody ever seen the old newsreel of that?
Yeah.
I mean, that's kind of cool, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
And he goes flap, 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 blip. And so man can't fly. That's reserved for the birds. Was it? Was it not true? The best mathematical minds have proven that man can never fly. Had not people said God had reserved that privilege for the birds? Only 30 years later, the conquest of air was almost an old story, and airplane travel was in full swing. This is written in 1939. Okay? So now they're starting to have plane travel. But what's so cool to me is the next paragraph. But in most fields, our generation has witnessed complete liberation of our thinking. Show any longshoreman a Sunday supplement describing a proposal to explore the moon by means of a rocket, and he will say, I bet they do it, maybe not so long either. 1939. You know, it was 30 years later that happened. Is not our age characterized by the ease with which we discard old ideas for new? By the complete readiness with which we throw away the theory or the gadget which does not work for something new which does. I have a cell phone that I can call and I can text. I'm the most unsophisticated person in this room because I know every one of you has a cell phone that can do more than that. You know that? I know some of you got a cell phone that you can look up Facebook on. I think that's fantastic. I ain't doing it. We had to ask ourselves why we shouldn't apply our human problems to the same readiness to change our point of view. We were having trouble with personal relationships. We couldn't control our emotional natures. We were prey to misery and depression. We couldn't make a living. We had a feeling of uselessness. We were full of fear. We were unhappy. We couldn't seem to be of real help to other people. Was not the basic solution of these bedevilments more important than whether we should see newsreels of lunar flight? Of course it is. When we saw, not heard, when we saw others solve their problems by a simple reliance upon the spirit of the universe, we had to stop doubting the power of God. Our ideas did not work. But if we saw in others, we saw that the God idea did. Top of page 53. Logic is great stuff. We liked it. We still like it. It is not by chance we are given the power to reason, to examine the evidence of our senses, and to draw conclusions. That is one of man's magnificent attributes. We agnostically inclined would not feel satisfied with a proposal which does not lend itself to a reasonable approach and interpretation. Hence, we are at pains to tell why we think our present faith is reasonable, why we think it is more sane and logical to believe than not to believe, why we say our former thinking was soft and mushy when we threw up our hands in doubt and said, we don't know. And you know what? Before I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, that was not something that I ever said. You asked me a question, I had an answer. It was probably the wrong answer, but as long as you didn't know it was the wrong answer, it was the right answer. I never said, I don't know. I say it all the time. I surprise the guys I work with when I go, I don't know. What do you mean you don't know? I go, go look it up. I don't know what page it's on. Page 62, probably. That's always an easy one for me. When we became alcoholics, crushed by a self-imposed crisis, nobody forced me to drink. We could not postpone or evade. We had to fearlessly face the proposition that either God is everything or else he is nothing. God either is or he isn't. And they give us a choice. What's my choice to be? What's your choice to be? Don't answer. But what's your choice? Arrived at this point, we are squarely confronted with the question of faith. We couldn't duck the issue. Some of us had already walked far over the bridge of reason towards the desired shore of faith. The outlines and the promises of the new land had brought luster to our tired eyes and fresh courage to flagging spirits. Friendly hands had stretched out in welcome. And I got AA written next to that. Friendly hands had reached out in welcome, because that's what we do. We were grateful that reason has brought us so far, but somehow we couldn't step ashore. Perhaps we had been leaning too heavy on reason that last mile, and we did not like to lose our support. You know, take a step out on faith. That was natural, but let us think a little more closely. Without knowing it, had we not been brought to where we stood by a certain kind of faith? Page 54. For did we not believe in our own reasoning? Did we not have confidence in our ability to think? What was that but a sort of faith? Yes, we'd been faithful, objectively faithful to the God of reason. So in one way or another, we discovered that faith had been involved all the time, just the wrong way. We found, too, that we had been worshipers. What a state of mental goose flesh that used to bring on. Goosebumps in my brain. Had we not variously worshipped people, sentiment, things, money, ourselves, and then with a better motive, had we not worshipfully beheld the sunset, the sea, or a flower, who of us has not loved something or somebody? How much did these feelings, these loves, this worship have to do with pure reason? Little or nothing, we saw at last. Were not these things the tissue out of which our lives were constructed? Did not these feelings, after all, determine the course of our existence? It was impossible to say that we had no capacity for faith or love or worship. In one form or another, we had been living by faith and little else. Imagine life without faith. Were nothing left but pure reason, it wouldn't be life. But we believed in life, of course we did. We could not prove life in the sense that you could prove a straight line is the shortest distance between two points. Yet there it was. Could we still say to the whole thing was nothing but a mass of electrons created of nothing, meaning nothing, whirling on in design of nothingness, or to a destiny of nothingness? Of course we couldn't. You know, the electrons themselves seemed more intelligent than I, or than that. At least so the chemist said. Hence we saw that reason isn't everything, neither is reason, as most of us use it, entirely dependable, though it emanate from our best minds. What about the people who proved that man could never fly? They were proved wrong. Yet we're seeing another kind of flight, a spiritual liberation from this world, people who rose above their problems. They said that God made these things possible, and we only smiled. We had seen spiritual release, but like to tell ourselves it wasn't true. If we see it, if you see spiritual release in somebody, why would I doubt it? Why would I say it isn't true? Actually, we were fooling ourselves. People say, I go to church to find God. People have looked for God all over the world. And here it tells you right where. For deep down in every man, woman, and child is a fundamental idea of God. Where is that? In my heart. In my heart. For deep down inside, every man, woman, and child is a fundamental idea of God. It may be obscured by calamity, by pomp, by worship of other things, but in some form or other, it is there. For faith in a power greater than ourselves and miraculous demonstrations of that power in human lives are facts as old as man himself. We finally saw that faith in some kind of God was a part of our makeup just as much as the feeling we have for a friend. Sometimes we had to search fearlessly, but he was there. He was as much a fact as we were. We found the great reality deep down within us. In the last analysis, it is only there that he may be found. He or she. And it was so with us. Yeah, I'm going to finish it. We can only clear the ground a bit. If our testimony helps sweep away prejudice, enables you to think honestly, encourages you to search diligently within yourself, then if you wish, you can join us on the broad highway. With this attitude, you cannot fail. The consciousness of your belief is sure to come to you. Okay, he goes on to say that in this book you will read the experience of a man who thought he was an atheist. The story is so interesting that some of it should be told now. His change of heart was dramatic and convincing and moving. Our friend was a minister's son. He attended church school where he became rebellious at what he thought was an overdose of religious education. For years thereafter, he was dogged by trouble and frustration, business failure, insanity, fatal illness, suicide. These calamities in his immediate family embittered and depressed him. Post-war disillusionment, ever more serious alcoholism, impending mental and physical collapse brought him to the point of self-destruction. Now, I don't have proof, and I'm looking for it, but I believe that we're talking about after Ebby came to Bill. One night when confined in the hospital, he was approached by an alcoholic, Ebby, who had known a spiritual experience. Our friend's gorge rose as he bitterly cried out, "Here's an alcoholic prayer. Here's an alcoholic prayer if I ever heard one. If there is a God, he certainly hasn't done anything for me." That's a prayer. You're talking to God. But later, alone in a room, he asked himself this question. Is it possible that all the religious people I have known are wrong? While pondering the answer, he felt as though he lived in hell. Then, like a thunderbolt, a great thought came. It crowded out all else. Who are you to say there is no God? Who are you, confined to a mental hospital, shaken from alcoholic delirium, who are you to say there is no God? This man recounts that he tumbled out of his bed onto his knees, and in a few seconds he was overwhelmed by a conviction of the presence of God. It poured over and through him with the certainty and majesty of a great tide at flood. The barriers he had built through the years were swept away. He stood in the presence of infinite power and love. He had stepped from the bridge to shore. For the first time he lived in the conscious companionship with his Creator. Thus was our friend's cornerstone fixed in place. No later vicissitude has shaken it. His alcoholic problem was taken away. That very night years ago, it disappeared, save for a few brief moments of temptation. The thought of drink never returned, and at such times great revulsion has risen up in him. Seemingly, he could not drink even if he would. God had restored his sanity. Step two. What is this but a miracle of healing? Yet its elements are simple. Circumstances made him willing to believe. He humbly offered himself to his Maker. Then he knew. Even so hath God restored all of us to our right minds. To this man the revelation was sudden. Some of us have to grow into it more slowly. See the spiritual appendix in the back of the book. But he has come to all who have honestly sought him. When we drew near to him, he disclosed himself to us. Okay? That's the end of that paragraph. I'm going to go to ask Bill sees it for a minute. And Bill sees it, and it's also going to be on page 100 when we get there. And I read this before, but I'm going to read it again. You know, it's on page 2 in as Bill sees it. My depression deepened unbearably, and finally it seemed to me as though I was very at the bottom of the pit. For the moment, the last vestige of my proud obstinacy was crushed. All at once I found myself crying out, if there is a God, here's a prayer, if there is a God, let him show himself. I am ready to do anything, anything. And this is Bill describing his spiritual experience. Suddenly the room lit up with a great white light, and it seemed to me in the mind's eye that I was on a mountain and that a wind not of air but of spirit was blowing. And then it burst upon me that I was a free man. Slowly the ecstasy subsided. I lay on the bed. But now for a time I was in another world, a new world of consciousness. All about me and through me there was a wonderful feeling of presence, and I thought to myself, so this is the God of the preachers. And he'll say that again on page 100 when we get there. I'm going to use another one of Bill's quotes here as Bill sees it. And I think it applies to me and maybe somebody else. Page 279, the fine art of alibis. The majority of AA members have suffered severely from self-justification during their drinking days. For most of us, self-justification was the maker of excuses for drinking and for all kinds of crazy and damaging conduct. We had made the invention of alibis a fine art. We had to drink because times were hard or times were good. We had to drink because at home we were smothered with love or we got none at all. We had to drink because at work we were great success or dismal failures. We had to drink because our nation had won a war or lost a peace. And so it went on ad infinitum. I had to drink because I was an alcoholic. Yeah, I can make up all the justifications I want. I had to drink because I couldn't do anything else. Now, I told you all last time that I was going to bring some different material in. This is Pass It On, the story of Bill Wilson and how AA message reached the world. And one of the things I wanted to bring in was the Oxford group used a set of principles that Bill kind of built on. And the Oxford group is where Bill went because there wasn't any AA at the time, 1935. That's where Dr. Bob was going out in Akron. The Oxford group was, you know, a non-denominational
evangelical.
But the principles that they used, Bill realized that he couldn't use all of them. All right? And one of them, they had four absolutes in the Oxford group. Absolute honesty, absolute purity, absolute unselfishness, absolute love. And Bill believed that the principles of honesty, purity, unselfishness, and love are as much a goal for AA members and are as much practiced by them as by any other group of people. Yet we found that when the word absolute was put in front of these attributes, they either turned people away by the hundreds or gave a temporary spiritual inflation resulting in collapse. So what they did was they used the principles as best they could, but they took out absolutes they took out, having to go out and aggressively force people to believe in something. They made it to where we could believe in what we wanted to believe as long as it was a power greater than ourselves. All right, we have reached page 57, and that means that next week we're going to read how it works. How about that?
Yeah, you know, if you were absolute in all those four attributes, you wouldn't be an alcoholic. You'd be perfect.
You think?
Yeah.
You think? And I'm not going to go into all the things that the Oxford group believed in and everything else. I can just tell you it was a great organization for a while.
Yeah.
For
like
a while.
And
then the university, Oxford University, asked them to quit using the name because of some of the controversies they got into, and they called it moral rearmament. All right?